Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Welcome to The Exchange. I'm Deirdre Bosa, in for Kelly Evans. Here's what's ahead on the show. Another strong jobs report, and one of our guests just changed her rate cut forecast because of it. She's here to tell us why and what she expects from the Fed going forward. Plus, a check on the consumer and one retail stock one analyst called well-positioned for gains, especially if we're higher for longer. He joins us with the name and how much upside he sees ahead. And higher for longer, that is not an issue for the ultra-rich. They are scooping up properties in one market in particular. We will tell you where, and we're going to talk to one of the power brokers behind some of those big deals. But we begin with today's markets and Dom Chu with the numbers. Dom, good news is good news, though markets could still likely notch a weekly loss.
All right, so Deirdre, to your point, it's strong green across the board right now. So strong that we've now put yesterday's downside volatility squarely in the rearview mirror. And by that, I mean the S&P 500 is currently trading at 5221. We closed on Wednesday's session before the sell-off on Thursday at 5211. So we've now gotten back every single nickel that we lost during yesterday's market sell-off with today's big rally. The S&P is up 1.5%, 73 points. That's the session high right now. Even at the lows, we were up 10 points. The S&P 500, again, a key focal point there. The Dow Industrials up north of 1%, 424-point gain, 39,021. The NASDAQ Composite, 16,320, up 271 points. That tech-heavier trade really starting to advance things up nearly 1.75%. Now, a big part of that story has been with regard to interest rates, especially in light of today's jobs number, hotter than expected. We did see a tick higher in yields by about 7 basis points for the 2-year benchmark note yield at current levels, currently 4.71%. And that kind of nearer term upside that we're seeing here has been weighing on markets, but stocks seemingly shrugging it off right now. Rate cut prospects again in focus. What has happened earlier today as well, after snapping a 7-day winning streak, are prices of gold, which hit yet another record high in today's session, currently trading at $2,346, up north of 1.5%. And that parabolic move that we've seen in gold prices continues to go higher. We'll see whether or not there's a cooling of that gold trade at any point down the line here in the future, on the short-term basis at the very least. And then a stock to keep a close eye on for that tech-heavier trade today is what's happening with Tesla shares, not participating in that broader rally that we're seeing overall in the NASDAQ, down 1.5%. And a lot of that downside coming earlier today on reports from Reuters citing sources that the company is abandoning its plans for an entry-level model for cars instead to focus on other parts of the business. Tesla shares reacting negatively to that. So, Deirdre, lots going on, but generally speaking, a very big update for the markets trying to shake off yesterday's big sell-off. I'll send things back over to you.
Dom, thank you. And we're going to start with today's stronger-than-expected jobs report and the fact that the market doesn't seem to care that stronger for longer could mean higher for longer. Steve Leisman, it's green across the board. I actually have this exact shirt in green, and I chose this morning red or green. I chose wrong. The markets are higher. Do they care?
Okay, I'm not going to sit here and comment publicly on your outfit. It looks fine to me. It's great. Keep going.
Okay, so is it that the markets don't care about jobs data, or they don't care as much as about CPI, for example, which we're getting next week?
I don't know. I think they had to undo what they did yesterday, which is, I think yesterday's sell-off was a little bit overdone. If it was on there was issues about Iran, there was issues about the Fed. I do also think that the Fed has telegraphed that the number, the headline payroll, is not as important as the inflationary indicators inside the numbers, like wages and the labor supply. I do want to talk real quickly, though, about Fed Governor Bowman, who just spoke and said her outlook is for lower inflation and rate cuts. That's her baseline, but she does see a lot of risk. I want to go through those risks real quick. Still not appropriate, she says, to lower the policy rate because of these uncertainties she has and the concern about upside inflation risk. I'll go through those real quickly. She says it's unclear if supply side improvements will continue. They've been the bulk of the reason why inflation has come down, in her view. The productivity boost we've had could be temporary. There are geopolitical developments and additional fiscal stimulus, along with her concern about housing inflation. I'll leave it there. Guys, just go to the chart. We'll go through the numbers today real quickly and show you what word do you like, Deirdre? Blowout, trouncing, whooping. What is the what's the best name to call this? 300,000 in the face of a 200,000 estimate, down from 275 or up from 275 in the prior month. We had a tick down in the unemployment rate. Average hourly earnings year over year fell to the lowest level since I think it was 2021, I believe. And the participation rate also went up by 2/10. So all that is good news with jobs in healthcare and social assistance and education. We had jobs in leisure and hospitality and some government jobs as well.
Yeah, I go back to your chart yesterday. It was actually above that higher end. So blowout sounds fine.
Okay.
That works.
I've seen a lot of interesting words.
Yes, at least you have some synonyms there. Stay there, Steve. Our next guest says that she's changing her forecast from 2 rate cuts to 2 from 3 to 2 this year, following the stronger than expected jobs report. Let's bring in Diane Swonk, chief economist at KPMG. Diana, was it this morning's job report, or has this kind of been trickling through your head this week as we're getting more comments from Fed members and, of course, Kashkari last night?
Well, we've been sitting on the fence on 2 and 3 for about 2 weeks now, and so this just tipped us over the fence. And I agree with Steve that the CPI numbers are more important than the jobs numbers, because Chair Powell himself said he welcomes strong employment numbers. But embedded in those employment numbers are also a tick up in hours worked. That's great. That's more earnings. But that keeps the underlying demand very strong in the economy. And again, the numbers in the service sector are so strong, 2/3 of the gains in those big three, leisure and hospitality, healthcare, and state and local governments. That's something we've seen for a long time. The good news is it's not quite as concentrated as it was in 2023, which means some of the gains are spreading out a little bit more. We saw some strong gains in construction as well, and retail still holding up in there. I think that's important to see more dispersed gains, because we're not as susceptible to negative shocks. But that gets to the risk that Steve laid out earlier, that there could be some upside risks for inflation going forward, given the strength in the economy and the persistence, particularly in the service sector.
And Steve, we've been talking a lot this week about that upside risk, whether you look at commodity prices or elsewhere, but that wage growth, right? A lot of folks are focusing on that number in the jobs report this morning. Does that tell us on the flip side, though, that the Fed has more room? What's sort of the next catalyst? Are we hearing from any more speakers?
Thankfully, I don't think so.
You've been busy this week.
I need 15 speakers.
Use a break.
I was about to crawl up in a fetal position on the last one, but it was 18 pages. But we got through it, folks. We read it, so you don't have to. That's what we do. That's our motto in the econ department. So listen, I think that the wage numbers are okay, as long as, here's the formula, the wage growth is not greater than the inflation number plus productivity. That is non-inflationary wage growth. I believe we're there. I do not believe, and Diana will always correct me when I'm wrong, that's one of her great attributes. I don't believe Fed officials have talked about wages pushing up inflation. I believe they've talked about the threat of wages pushing up inflation. So that does not appear to be part of their construct of the dynamic right now.
Okay.
Let me just make one more point.
And I think that's important.
Diane, real quick, I want to make a point on the construction thing. I looked that up. Very interesting. Non-residential specialty trade contractors.
Yep. Specialty.
Who are those? The people doing the government projects. So we might be seeing some of the infrastructure bill showing up in the jobs report. That's maybe, I got to look back and see historically, but that's what those folks are. 39,000.
Diane, go ahead.
Yep. Oh, and that number was up from, 19,000 on average for the last 12 months? So 39,000. It was a big number. And in a month where seasonally we expect construction to pick up because it's March, and that's when spring usually comes most places, although in Chicago it seemed to be lacking. But I think that number was important, too. But more broadly, we're also got a lot of dry tinder in the housing market. And it's been interesting to see the Fed officials talk about the persistence of inflation in the shelter sector. That has been interesting, seeing it come out of someone like Austin Goolsbee's mouth this week. And I think we've all heard enough from Fed officials, but it's all been more moving down their number of rate cuts rather than moving up their number of rate cuts.
Steve, I wonder if you can break down this idea of immigration and how this is sort of keeping the job market strong and also relating to some of those housing and renting prices.
So I'll preface this by saying the Fed wants to stay away from inflation like it's the immigration like it's the plague. It does not want to weigh in on the politics of it. And what they're doing is they're taking the cards that are dealt to them. The cards that have been dealt to them is much higher immigration. I believe that the CBO just upgraded by like 4 million the number of immigrants that are in this country, documented, I guess, and undocumented as well. Those folks are showing up in the payroll report. They seem to be bodies that we are able to put to work. And what the wages are at those levels, I'm a little bit unclear how much of that is on the books. I believe that they seem to be mostly, or at least ending up in some counted way on the books, on the tax rolls in that respect. So that's an interesting question that we need to get to the bottom of. But immigration numbers are fueling job growth. Job growth is fueling growth. We appear to have a very large demand for labor in this country. Right. And going back to the source of this whole thing, I don't think, I'll get some hate mail on this, but what the heck. I don't think people are leaving their homes thousands of miles away and walking here because they don't believe they have the prospect of getting a job. They appear to have the prospect of getting a job.
Right.
And this economy appears to need them to put them to work.
Right.
I'll stop there.
There's openings. Diane,
and what are the two number one reasons? Yeah, the two number one reasons people move here is to work and to buy a home. And they're trying to buy into the American dream. And I think that's really important. We also know in the data in the last 2 months, foreign-born workers did pick up quite dramatically and were dramatically absorbed in those that were employed. And we know that that's helped to balance out supply and demand in the labor market. And that supply of being able to have those workers out there to be able to work, and they are paying taxes and showing up on the books. And I think that is important as well. There are obviously a lot of political issues here, Steve, and we know them. They stress local communities. It's really hard. This is not a perfect situation. We need some immigration reform, but Congress hasn't decided on that, even though they seem to have agreed. I don't know what's going on. I'm not going to try to handicap that. But the more important issue is they are both helping the labor market come into more balance, one of those supply-side issues that's on the good side, but they also do add to demand.
And it creates issues for local government services as well. I will point out, I'm pretty sure there is no way, Deirdre, for an unskilled worker to come into this country in a documented way unless they're a from a refugee, a known place where refugees are accepted from. So there is no legal route or documented route in for an unskilled worker.
Right.
But we seem to have a huge demand.
And coming in. A lot of them
get hired into the food services industry. But
the services
I just want to add the one last thing is record number of people out taking care of people in the month as well.
Diane and Steve, thank you very much for kicking us off there. My next guest says that we're now in the sweet spot for the economy, inflation, and for the markets. For more on how to position against this backdrop, I'm joined by Silas Myers, co-founder and portfolio manager at Mar Vista Investment Partners. Silas, thanks for being with us. Let me just throw this idea at you. Are we paying too much attention to rate cuts, what may or may not be on the table when you've got a strong economy and we're heading into earnings next week?
Yeah, I mean, we obviously had a very strong job market, job report today, which shows the underlying strength of the economy. And we've been spending a lot of time as a market really focused on what the Fed was going to do. And that started in December. Six cuts were the expectation, quickly moved to three. And then when you have reports like today, it really complicates the Fed decision because you've got the underlying economy doing fairly well. And inflation is at bay, and in fact has been declining. So ultimately, in our opinion, the Fed may cut less than three times this year. And a lot of that's been priced in, but ultimately, we think that the interest rate regime that we're in right now is actually be okay for the economy.
Right.
So you wouldn't be surprised if it didn't cut at all.
And you've seen markets stay resilient from five cuts to three to maybe two this year. How are you positioning for the rest of the year? Obviously, in the first quarter, we saw the rally expand out to other sectors. It hasn't just been the Magnificent Seven. It's been the Fab Four. It's been other sectors, especially focused on commodities. How are you positioning yourself going into the rest of the year?
Well, yeah, I mean, at Mar Vista, we believe that when we've had a real strong first quarter like we had this year, you know, it bodes well for the rest of the year. And we're seeing strength in the types of companies that we like to own at our firm that are really focused on wide moats, have extraordinary opportunities to create shareholder value through investments into the business as well as M&A, and with really strong capital allocators at the helm. So we're positioned with some leverage to more of the industrial space, some in technology as well as basically insurance.
I want to ask you about... I'm sorry to interrupt you, Silas. I want to get to gold because we're seeing, you know, fresh record highs. We've been looking at it all week. What is it telling us here? Is it telling us that maybe the markets are being more driven by geopolitics than they are Fed speak and the number of rate cuts that may or may not be on the table?
Yeah, I mean, I think that geopolitics is more of an exogenous event. And typically when you've had those, the market rebounds fairly quickly. So it's hard to manage an investment process around a geopolitical risk. And in Mar Vista, we think more longer term, ultimately, you know, having an average of 5-year holding period, short-term events aren't as important to us as giving the management teams of our investments the opportunity to execute on their business strategies and grow shareholder value. So I think there's some impact, obviously, from the risk of geopolitics, particularly it hit to oil prices and increase in oil prices despite production increasing. But ultimately, thinking 3, 5, 8 years down the line, you know, a lot of the businesses that we own and have in our universe, we think will do extremely well.
Okay, from the macro, I want to go micro as well and ask you specifically about Tesla. Obviously, Tesla is Tesla, trade sort of on its own. However, could it be seen as perhaps a canary in the coal mine as we head into earnings season? We saw that big drop on the back of disappointing deliveries and then today's report that might not be producing its low-end model after all, another drop. Could that be an indication that if we see companies miss even slightly over the next few weeks going into earnings, we could see the market punish them more than they maybe have over the last year?
Yeah, and Tesla really is, I think a lot of the issues there are idiosyncratic, not necessarily economic. They've got more competition now. They've had to cut prices in order to compete. They've been having challenges with production. But ultimately, what's important to us at Mar Vista is, you know, a company's ability to outperform expectations. And in many of our companies, particularly in the aerospace and industrial gas industry, we're seeing the second half looking fairly solid and a good recovery off of a lower comp base from the last year's second half. And in fact, management teams have been commenting that they see second half of 2024 looking stronger than first half and started to see those green shoots already in Q1 and Q2.
And those expectations, not just for the Mag 7, but more broadening. Silas Myers, thank you so much for being with us. And by the way, also, we did hear from Elon Musk, who denied that Reuters report. And by the way, do not miss Sarah Eisen's interview with Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. That's live in Beijing on Monday. And coming up, finding value in Vice City, the world's richest person buying another mansion in Miami. But there is a long list of billionaires scooping up real estate in South Florida. We've got the details and an inside look at the ultra-luxury market ahead. First, though, here's a look at our mystery chart of the day. A retailer our next guest says can rally nearly 30% from here, despite all the uncertainty in the macro environment. We will reveal it and tell you why it stands out. That's next. The Exchange is back after this.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Consumers have been feeling the impact of higher mortgage rates and creeping gas prices. The national average for regular gasoline up over 20 cents from this time last month. Against this backdrop, the XRT retail ETF, it's on pace for its worst week in over a year, down nearly 6% since Monday. But my next guest says there's one stock in that bunch that is actually well positioned from here and benefits from a depressed housing market, high gas prices and high interest rates. That's Ollie's Bargain Outlet, our mystery chart that we showed you earlier on. Joining us now for more is Anthony Chukwumba, Loop Capital Senior Analyst. Anthony, you see a 26% upside for the stock from here. And this really says a lot about where the consumer is right now, down market looking for deals and discounts.
That's correct. I mean, the macroeconomic environment is still highly uncertain. I mean, we're seeing some very strong indicators, right, like that much better than expected jobs number today. Mm-hmm. But as you said, I mean, the housing market's still pretty depressed. Interest rates are pretty high. Gas prices are creeping back up. There's a lot of uncertainty. And so we think that plays right into Ollie's hands. Given that uncertainty, we think that consumers will look to trade down from higher priced alternatives and they know they can save when they go to Ollie's Bargain Outlet.
Now, elsewhere in sort of the bargain space, when you look at Dollar General versus Family Dollar, they've been sort of moving in different directions in terms of expansion and closing down stores in the case of Family Dollar. Why is that? Where does Ollie's Bargain fit?
Yeah, so, you know, look, we cover Dollar Tree, which owns Family Dollar, as well as Dollar General. Those models are a little bit different, right? I mean, they're 75% consumable, 25% discretionary. I mean, they're essentially like kind of small supermarkets. Mm. Now, you know, talk about idiosyncratic. I mean, you know, there's a lot of optimism at Dollar General because they're CEO Todd Vasos has recently rejoined the company, and there's a lot of expectation he's going to turn the business around. The early results have been quite encouraging. With Family Dollar, you know, they just can't sort of get out of their own way, and they did announce they're going to close a bunch of stores. But those are in a very different position now. Now, theoretically, they should benefit from that trade down as well. But both of them are having operational issues right now. Ollie's has no operational issues like Dollar General and Family Dollar do.
Anthony, I've spent a lot of time over the last year or so covering the rise of these Chinese e-commerce companies, Shein, more retail-oriented, but Temu is essentially an online dollar store with almost unbeatable prices. Does it present competition to an Ollie's Bargain?
I don't really think so. I mean, remember, Ollie's Bargain Outlet, it's a treasure hunt environment, and you really have to kind of go to the store to see what's in the store. And you just, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to replicate that experience online. So I really don't see a Temu or Shine as a significant competitive threat to Ollie's Bargain Outlet.
Okay. Just on the broader retail space, it's been a very rough week. XRT on pace for its worst week in more than a year. What do you think is going on here at large? Is this a broader consumer slowing? Is it competitive issues, both?
So we've gotten a couple of, you know, tough data points this week. So you had PVH, you know, and they had their miss. Now, a lot of that seems like had to do with Europe. But then on top of that, you had Ulta Beauty talking about a slowdown. Mm-hmm. And that really kind of freaked some people out as well. And so, and then obviously, if suddenly we're talking about maybe going from 3 rate cuts to 2 rate cuts to maybe no rate cuts, you know, that's not necessarily seen as something positive for the retail industry. But a lot of this, you know, I mean, when I look at the macroeconomic tea leaves, I think that they're overall, even though they're somewhat mixed, they're a lot more positive ones than negative ones. And generally, if a consumer is working, right, and we saw unemployment tick down and is making more money, and we've seen wage growth continue to be quite strong ahead of inflation, they're going to continue to spend.
Right. Resilient economy, resilient consumer. Morgan Stanley says the U.S. consumer is healthy, but just slowing around the edges. They say kind of hold on because 2025 should be the start of the next cycle. Do you agree with that?
I think so. But quite frankly, I'm not sure if we need to wait till 2025. I mean, things are pretty strong right now in 2024. And then if we do get those rate cuts, that'll just be additional firepower.
Right. Anthony, great to get your insights. Thanks for coming on. Anthony Chukwumba. Coming up, the rise of the robots becoming big tech's newest AI battleground, with Apple seemingly going all in after shutting down its long-running car project. We will look at the biggest players, including Amazon, with the stock trading at its highest level since November 2021. And as we go to break, Here's a look at the worst performers in the S&P since Monday, including Lamb Weston, Ulta, which Anthony just mentioned, Intel, and Walgreens, all down double digits and having their worst week since 2020. It's also Lamb Weston's second worst week on record. We're back right after this.
Hi, I'm Ben. I suffer from a condition called writer's block. It strikes when I'm at work. That's why I choose Canva Magic Write. It works fast, generating texts in seconds, thanks to AI.
Common side effects include increased productivity, compliments from coworkers, feelings of satisfaction.
Now I can say bye-bye to writer's block.
Ask your boss if Canva Magic Write is right for you at canva.com, designed for work.
Welcome back to The Exchange. You're looking at markets right now. The Dow high was 443. We're sitting pretty close to that above 350 points, up about 1%. The S&P 500 up about 0.2%. But the NASDAQ is really leading the way today, up 1.5%. And the 10-year yield holding below 4.4. The major indices, though, they're still headed for a losing week, with the Dow the biggest laggard. As you can see, it's on pace for a loss of more than 2% this week. If this holds, the NASDAQ, not too bad, maybe end the week down about 0.5%. Energy has really been a lot of the story this week. It's been the best performing sector, with oil touching its highest level since October. WTI crude is also showing a bullish golden cross technical pattern, where the 50-day moving average crosses above an ascending 200-day moving average. If this holds, it will be the first time the 50 closes above the 200 since December. That is helping push a number of energy stocks towards new all-time highs, including ExxonMobil, Marathon, Petroleum, Valero, and Phillips 66. Now let's get over to Tyler Matheson for a CNBC News update.
Thank you very much, Deirdre. President Biden just arrived in Baltimore to visit the site of that deadly Key Bridge collapse from a week or so ago. He's scheduled to take an aerial tour of the scene and get an update on operations there. The White House said today that the Army Corps of Engineers expects to restore the port to normal capacity by the end of May. Federal authorities investigating New York Mayor Eric Adams's campaign fundraising are reportedly looking into valuable flight upgrades he received from Turkish Airlines. That's according to the New York Times, which says it's part of a broader corruption inquiry of a Turkish Airlines exec and aides to Mayor Adams. A lawyer for the mayor says the Times there's nothing improper and that he did nothing in exchange for the upgrades. And Richard Branson's Virgin Voyages cruise line launched a month-long excursion aimed at remote workers. The Scarlet Summer Season Pass will take two people through the southern Europe for just under $10,000. The rate includes a room, meals, Wi-Fi, and access to workspaces. The company tells CNBC Travel that more than 2,000 people expressed interest in the voyage within the first 24 hours. Dee, back to you.
I wonder how employers would respond to that,
yeah,
who want people back in the office 5 days a week. Tyler, thanks. See you soon. Coming up, we've got a deeper dive into this morning's stronger-than-expected jobs report, including an under-the-radar Fed factor that is having a major impact on the broader economy. And there is still time to register for the inaugural CNBC Changemakers event in New York City on April 18th. We'll hear from some of the women transforming business, including Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo. To request an invite, you can scan the QR code on the screen or go to cnbcevents.com/changemakers. Welcome back to The Exchange. The March jobs report stronger than expected, with the broader unemployment rate dropping to 3.8%. Diving deeper into the data, though, the jobless rate for Asians and Hispanics both fell sharply to 2.5% and 4.5%, respectively. But for Blacks, the unemployment rate actually surged to 6.4%, and that is the highest level since August of 2022. Joining me now to discuss this disparity in jobs and the impact on the economy is Mark Morial, president and CEO of National Urban League and the former mayor of New Orleans. Thanks so much for being with us. First, talk about why we have this disparity and what can we do about it?
It's not easily explainable, but it must have something to do with discrimination in hiring practices. I mean, how else could you explain this sort of aberration where the joblessness rate for every other ethnic group has gone down with the exception of African Americans? So I was surprised to see it, because this is otherwise a hot jobs report, mm-hmm, with significant job creation, 300,000 plus, 276,000 jobs average per month over the last year or so, 26 straight months. of job creation above 200,000. It's a strange look. So what we should look for is whether this is an aberration, meaning a one-time occurrence, and what the job report looks like for African Americans next year. If we see a trend, there's something happening out there that needs to be aggressively addressed.
If it is a trend, Mark, what tools are out there to basically fix it or do something about this?
Well, I think we should wait and see. I mean, it would be easy for me to react very quickly to this, but I'd like to see if it's a trend. But what we have, unfortunately, is still this last hired, first fired, if you will, phenomenon. And it may have something to do with these aggressive attacks on DE&I that are taking place. The impact of it being to drive up the Black unemployment rate. If that is so, then we're seeing a retreat from many commitments that were made post George Floyd in this nation towards a more equitable and just future. But I'm going to urge that this is a sign of concern, but I want to see, because from time to time we see in the jobs report months that are aberrational to the trend. Let's wait and see, but trust me, we're going to keep a close eye on this.
Yeah, and important to highlight. I wonder, Mark, what's the impact of higher rates? Does that have a disproportionate effect on this part of the population as well when you have things like higher credit card debt and mortgage rates?
Look, when people are not working, they can't meet the basic necessities of life. So the higher the unemployment rate for any community, it makes it harder for them to meet the necessity of taking care of themselves and their loved ones. And that is simply a fact. In an economy with this type of growth rate and with these type of unemployment rates, we should see these declines taking place across the board. The demand for workers, and this is what we see, is very, very strong in the American economy today.
Right. And Mark, I wonder, finally, you could just sort of comment on where you think interest rates are going this year and how many are on the table. Do you think the economy is looking very strong by those top line numbers? Of course, there's nuances within them. But do you think there's more risk to the Fed waiting or cutting too soon?
Well, look, the Fed should stick to its plan to cut three times on the timetable they've outlined. What's important for Fed policy is for people to trust their plan and for us to be able to understand what the expectations are. In my view, we'd like to see the cuts take place sooner rather than later. Why? What's driving some of the lingering inflation are housing costs, which represent one third of the consumer price index. So by addressing, driving down interest rates and making housing more affordable, making home ownership a little bit more affordable, it could have a positive impact on not only economic growth, but also on inflation.
Mark Muriel, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Deidre. Thank you.
By the way, mark your calendar for CNBC's second annual Game Plan Summit on September 10th in Los Angeles. The event brings together industry leaders and visionaries from the sports and entertainment worlds. To learn more and register, you can scan that QR code right on your screen or go to cnbcevents.com/gameplan. Coming up, a rush into robotics. We will look at big tech's new battleground and who is pulling ahead of the competition. The Exchange is back in just 2 minutes. Welcome back to The Exchange. Robots are emerging as the latest battleground in big tech, with Apple reportedly jumping into the space, scrapping its EV plans to go all in on home robots instead. Kate Rooney is here with more. Cars, robots are all kind of the same, right?
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of overlap there, Dee. Apple is the latest example of this move into robotics, but you've got Amazon, Tesla, Microsoft, Google, and NVIDIA all competing now in robotics, which has been helped by some recent leaps in artificial intelligence. Amazon has been at this for about a decade as the largest producer now of industrial robots in its fulfillment centers. The play here, at least for Amazon, is to reduce cost and to increase speed, with more than 750,000 bots at this point assisting with about 75% of orders for Amazon. But Apple's reported entrance means more competition for Amazon and at least those at-home robots. It's got its Astro model. Still a wait list for that. It's not widely available yet, but the larger battleground appears to be in something called humanoid robots. As the name suggests, they walk, they sometimes talk like people. Goldman Sachs estimates could be a $38 billion market there. NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang showcased a fleet of these during their recent conference out here. He announced NVIDIA's own robotics-related project called Groot. Elon Musk, meanwhile, has been a big backer of these human-like robots. Tesla's Optimus has been a key priority for the CEO and for the company. On a recent earnings call, Musk said it has the potential to be more significant than the vehicle business at some point. The private market is also booming. The biggest year for funding was 2021, as COVID really underlined the need for automation. Worth noting some challenges, though, in the M&A market in this space. Amazon's effort to buy iRobot was blocked by regulators. Many are turning to venture investments in some of these partnerships. Amazon, for example, has invested in one called Agility, and then another Figure is backed by NVIDIA and Microsoft.
So, Kate, it's interesting here because the companies you mentioned, all the mega caps, very different reasons for building this. And Amazon, it's always seemed kind of obvious because they have so many of these warehouses and they're in the logistics business. And I always thought that that was sort of coming a lot sooner than an actual robot in the house. Amazon has one, right? But is it like real? Are they trying to sell it? I think it's $1,500. Do we have any indication of how those have done? What's it called again? The Amazon
one? Called Astro. So it's a great point. I think the logistics and fulfillment centers make a ton of sense. You could justify spending big on robotics if it's helping with speed and efficiency. So it's made sense for a long time with Amazon. Where they may have an advantage is if they're able to transfer some of that knowledge over to the consumer side. I would say with Amazon, it's still unproven. Now, this is an expensive item. Apple customers are used to paying that premium. Folks I've been talking to, venture investors, at least in robotics, have said Amazon's case in sort of the consumer side is not as obvious because they're not really looking for that premium customer. In most instances, people go on Amazon looking for a discount. Are they going to be willing to pay $1,000 for an Amazon robot? Whereas with Apple, they may be. You're seeing that with the headsets and other premium products. They've proven that people will pay more for an Apple product. So that is sort of a competition here, but it'll be interesting to see when that is more fully rolled out how it does and what it gets you, right? It might be able to, it's not a human robot. It's not going to do your laundry, which would be nice.
Or wash your windows. Actually, I think I saw a company that's doing that, robots to wash your windows. But let me ask you, the humanoid robots, when I think about them, when I think about robot dogs, I think about Boston Dynamics, right? They were sort of doing this very early on. Now that megacap's getting into this space, where does that leave them?
It's interesting. They were one of the first movers with, you remember, Spot. It didn't really have the dexterity. It was sort of, it looked like a dog. The artificial intelligence advancements have helped companies like Boston Dynamics. They've got more of like the military contracts that you think about. They really were an early mover. AI is a big part of this, where they have said in recent years that they have been able to take some of those leaps and move forward and get things like that human dexterity that wasn't a possibility when Boston Dynamics launched and really became that first mover. You could see this as a threat with big tech coming in. They've got obviously deep pockets and some of the machine learning advantages here. They've got those computer vision advantages. So they are sort of these new entrants and more competition with more funding. So could be seen as a risk, but Boston Dynamics really has been so far ahead of this and has all of these government contracts. They've really been a leader.
There's a few of those wow moments, like the robot doing a backflip, and then I think it was most recently Tesla's robot holding an egg like that. So a lot of advancements are coming quickly. Okay, Rooney.
I remember, you also mentioned it around GTC that somebody said, this is such a strong anecdote, that you'll, instead of typing on a computer, you'll interact with it. That's kind of what you're seeing with robots. You're seeing these more conversational robots pop up as well.
My kids already try to talk at screens. Kate Rooney, thanks again. Coming up, billionaires are buying up properties in South Florida. Robert Frank is here with that story. Robert.
Well, Dee, the billionaires are taking their talents to Miami along with their real estate dollars. A string of deals for over $100 million is taking prices to a whole new level. We're going to take a look at the most exclusive islands in Miami, who's buying, and whether the Miami luxury boom can continue. The Exchange is back right after this.
There are only 41 homes on Miami's lavish Indian Creek Island, also known as Billionaire's Bunker, and Jeff Bezos now owns three of them. And that is just one of many recent 8- and 9-figure deals in South Florida. Here to discuss is Dinah Goldentyre, Douglas Elliman's ultra-luxury specialist, and our very own Robert Frank, CNBC Wealth Editor. Robert, is this part of a larger luxury migration to Miami? But I feel like it's been going on.
It's been going on, but this week, this past week, has just brought this to a whole new level. You look at Jeff Bezos paying $90 million for that property, that third property you just mentioned on Indian Creek. He's now spent $250 million just on land before he even builds the new house. You got that waterfront compound in Miami Beach, that's North Miami Beach. That sold for well over $100 million. Two penthouses on Fisher Island just sold for $150 million. This all follows Ken Griffin taking his talents to Miami, paying $107 million for a waterfront estate, plus seven properties on Star Island totaling more than $170 million. He's also building a new home there. Dina, I know all these billionaires are your clients. What are you hearing in the market right now, and what does it feel like?
Well, Robert, thank you so much for having me today. They're not all my clients, but about half of them are. You know, the market is extremely hot. It's such an exciting time to do luxury real estate in Miami because we've never seen this level of action before.
And, you know, we know Bezos is moving there from Seattle, and that followed that tax increase in Seattle. But we, you know, there was that mass migration during the pandemic. Has it slowed down, or is there something else driving this latest leg of the market?
It hasn't slowed down. It's just found a new wave of activity. A lot of the players are already here and are just adding to their real estate portfolio or acquiring their neighbor to complete their compound. They have already redomiciled and are now really planting roots.
And we know that prices don't go to the sky. And we know that, you know, you go to Miami right now, and even that picture behind you, you see all the sky cranes. There are a lot of projects going up and a lot of very expensive product coming on the market. When does supply catch up and we start to see a moderation, or maybe not a bust, but Miami's famous for these hyper cycles?
They are. Miami has always been known for shorter boom cycles. We'd be up 2.5 years, we'd be down 2.5 years. But what this cycle is showing us is that we've entered a very healthy period of growth for the real estate market of Miami and Miami Beach. I see us on a 10-year trajectory in the same way that Los Angeles or New York or Boston have typically performed, where we are just smooth sailing and a couple of percentage points up every year without the intense boom and bust cycles that Miami was previously known for.
Are there new ways of extending that cycle? We have social media, we have Netflix series. It seems like there's just so much mainstream interest in high-end real estate. When are we going to get the selling billionaires bunker? Or is it just another class of people that is sort of unique to itself? Yeah.
We can start calling it that.
So are there tools? Can that keep the cycle going?
I think those tools are incredible for marketing, and I certainly rely quite heavily on my social media. On Instagram, I'm at Golden Dina, and I have a platform, a trademark, that Step Inside with me, and I have so many eyes on my top listings. But the reality, what the state of Florida is doing to attract ultra-high net worth wealth individuals with their policies is probably the most important thing for keeping this market prolonged.
And Dina, it feels almost at this point like a competition between at least these two billionaires. Ken Griffin came down there and he clearly wanted to be the king of Miami real estate, spending more than $250 million just on real estate. He doesn't even have his house yet that he's going to build. And then Jeff Bezos comes down there, $90 million on Indian Creek. Which is better, Star Island, which is the Ken Griffin, he's building his massive place, or Indian Creek? And do you feel like it's the competition between these two guys right now?
That's such a good question. Griffin is still very much the MVP of the marketplace, but Bezos is the new quarterback in town and is giving him a run for his money.
Well, quarterback, you mentioned quarterback. Tom Brady is also building, maybe even finished his place on Indian Creek. And is Jeff Bezos going to build a new house? And if he does, what's he going to do? Is this $90 million house that he just bought, is that a teardown, or has that become like a guest house on that property?
His new $90 million acquisition is just two doors down from Brady's house. I think he's going to live in it for about 5 years while he builds the compound that he's created a little further down the island. And then perhaps this lovely house becomes his $90 million guest house.
I mean, I can just see the series taking shape as you're talking. Quick one, Dina. We only have like less than a minute left. What about the role of foreign buyers here?
The role of foreign buyers are really not the primary consumer of Miami Beach real estate right now. If they do find their way back into the marketplace, it will just keep our market booming even longer.
It's like New Yorkers are the new Brazilians right. when it comes to Miami because they've replaced them at the top.
Canadians,
it's amazing.
The new Brazilians.
The Canadians. Okay, there we have it. The snowbirds.
There you go.
Come all around. Thank you, Dina, Robert Frank.
Thank you.
That does it for The Exchange.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.